Welcome to Camp Constitution Radio with your host, Hal Shurtleff. This show is heard on WBCQ The Planet every Monday night at 7:30 Eastern Standard Time, broadcast out of Monticello, Maine, in Arista County, and heard all over the world. Also, you can hear this show on YouTube. We will, on a regular basis, we'll make this show available on our YouTube channel, Camp Constitution's YouTube channel, and also on IPMNation.org, Saturday afternoons at 1:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I just want to mention a few things before we bring on our guest. Camp Constitution just uploaded something that supporters of Common Core do not want you to see. It is the Common Core Sexuality Standards. If you visit our website, campconstitution.net, and you go to downloads, it'll be the very last one. And it's the Common Core Sexual Standards created in part by SECUS, S-I-E-C-U-S, the infamous SECUS that's been involved in so-called sex education since the mid to late 60s. This standards is extremely anti-family, anti-Christian, anti-moral. It's really propaganda because it starts at K to 12. So we're talking about 5 and 6 year olds being introduced to these matters of so-called transgender families and same-sex families and other things like this. And as Dr. Duke Pastor pointed out in his presentations, that the mind at that age is not developed enough to understand these things, and what they're doing is pure propaganda. And you'll say, well, wait a minute now, they don't have health and health courses in the kindergarten, first, second, third, up, and not until probably 7th or 8th grade. That's right. These programs will be introduced in the math and the English. You look at math problems, you look at the English literature that they be using. So that's how they do that. That's how they get away with it, get around it. Anyway, also we encourage you to look at our Sam Blumenfeld archives. We're averaging about 160,000 views per month on that, and we hope to increase that. Tonight's guest is with the Massachusetts Family Institute. Mike, are you there?
Actually, this is Andrew Beckwith.
Andrew. Oh, how you doing, Andrew? Okay, I knew it was either you,
good,
or Mike or Andrew. Oh, great. Well, thank you for coming on. I'm very honored to have you. And
yeah,
you gave me, I think it was either Mike at the homeschool show, in Mass Hope Homeschool Show, you gave me this very important book called Engage the Bay State. Although, let's say you can put any state there, that because I think every state needs this. Let me just read a little blip that's about you. You're a native of West Newbury, Massachusetts, which is up on the North Shore of Boston. Graduated from summa cum laude from Gordon College. And by the way, you want to maybe talk about what happened in Gordon College, because I think you have some information in the book about that.
Absolutely.
You served in the Marine Corps, judge advocate in Japan, and continues to serve our country in the Marine Corps Reserves with a rank of major. Andrew was a man of strong faith and devotion to his wife, Karen, and their 4 children. He joined the board of MFI, Massachusetts Family Institute, in 2010 and took on the role of president in 2010. Andrew uses his training as a litigator and his experience advocating for family values to educate and equip people of faith to make a difference in our culture. From the State House to local schools and houses of worship, Andrew is dedicated to leading MFI's mission of strengthening the family and affirming the Judeo-Christian values upon which it is based. So welcome to the show, Andrew.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me on.
And I live in Boston, too, and we are really, what we say, behind enemy lines. And but I still think that there are lots of godly people in the state and in other parts of the country, of course. So tell us a little about the MFI, and then what prompted you to do this this Engage. It's not just a book, but it's also a study guide and something that your organization will be introducing to schools, not colleges, but churches around the state.
Right. It's a video series. So the 10 sessions, the book has 8 chapters. 2 of the chapters are in 2 parts. So 10 sessions, and the book goes with videos. Actually, companies, a 10-part video series that we produced, about 20 to 25 minutes per session. So it's really designed for someone to, you know, go into that adult or Sunday school class Sunday morning or small group and just hit play, and it kind of teaches itself. And then there's discussion questions at the end of each chapter and plenty of material, background material there, so folks want to talk about these things. And So what we do at Mass Family Institute, our overall mission is to strengthen the family, family values, and the Judeo-Christian values upon which the institution of the family is based. Now, as you can imagine, that is a full-time job here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. But we're not alone. We're part of a nationwide network associated with Focus on the Family, as well as Alliance Defending Freedom, which is a Christian legal ministry based out of Scottsdale, Arizona, and Family Research Council with Tony Perkins out of D.C., which does the work we do sort of on the national scale with U.S. Congress and the president there. But we're Massachusetts-focused. That's our mission field, and we work through research, education, and advocacy to promote family values. And when we talk about family values, we mean specifically the sanctity of life from conception to natural death, the dignity of natural marriage, and really all of God's design for human sexuality, and increasingly preserving our constitutional right to religious liberty. And in my line of work, there's three things I was sort of told when I was growing up you're not supposed to talk about in public: sex, religion, and politics. And my job is essentially now to talk about all three at once.
All three of them, right.
As I'm doing tonight, oftentimes on radio or TV. So my wife prays a lot and sometimes cringes. But the reason why I talk about these things all at once is because it's precisely at the intersection of all three that there's so much confusion, controversy, and brokenness in our culture. And so through our research and advocacy, we've learned a lot about the forces behind the LGBT movement or the pro-abortion movement in Massachusetts, what they're trying to do through the halls of government and the power of the state. So we're trying to educate people, particularly the church. So literally, preaching to the choir on what is going on, what the Bible says about these fundamental moral issues. A lot of times you'll have even pastors say, well, these are political issues. We don't want to get involved in politics. But these issues of life and human sexuality, these are fundamentally moral issues that have become politicized. But that doesn't mean the church doesn't have a key role to play in helping people discern how we can act as salt and light in the civic arena, in the public square. And goodness knows we need it. So we developed this curriculum. So I met with a pastor a few years ago, and I told him about the mission of MFI and kind of got into the details of some of the pending legislation. The bathroom bill was one of them at that time. And he said, that sounds really fascinating. We need people to get educated on this. But as a pastor, I can't talk about all those things from the pulpit. It's just too much information, and I don't have the ability to get the requisite expertise, but sounds like great material for a Sunday school class. So I took him up on that offer and created a Sunday school class and taught at that church. And what we found is that people were really hungry to have a safe space where they could discuss these things with other believers and really go through these tough issues like abortion, assisted suicide, same-sex marriage, sex ed in the schools, like you mentioned with the Common Core, transgenderism, religious liberty, and kind of what's on the horizon. And to do it from a biblical perspective. So we go and look at the scriptures. What do the scriptures say about these types of behaviors? I mean, there's nothing new under the sun. Things are repackaged, but it's all in there in the scriptures, really. And then what is the history legally, culturally, politically in America on these issues? How do we get, to where we are now? And then what's the history right here in Massachusetts? And what is going on right now in our Commonwealth on these issues? And what can we do about it? And that is sort of the makeup of the class. Like I said, there's 10 sessions, video footage that goes with each session. So it's designed for small groups and Sunday school classes to really give people a primer on these hot issues of the day. And hopefully if pastors are preaching on the underlying moral issues from the pulpit, then this will really equip people to meet the challenges because, we know people are getting hammered on these issues sort of outside the four walls of the church in the media. Movies, newspapers, TV, people at work, people at school, Facebook pushing certain agendas. And if we don't talk about it in the church, then people are not going to get the truth anywhere else. That's the one venue left where we'll get God's truth on these contentious and oftentimes confusing issues. So I think it's critically important to do that. And we're trying to bring sort of the public policy expertise to bear on that because it can be very confusing.
Well,
that's what the Engaged curriculum is about.
Yeah, it's interesting you said preaching to the choir. I actually like the term teaching to the choir because it's been my experience.
Yeah.
It's been in my experience that a lot of Christians sometimes they're relatively new Christians, and they've been influenced by we're all influenced by this culture to some extent,
yeah.
Our children and what have you, but they come into the church without really an understanding. They make their profession of faith, that's great, but they don't understand their role as a citizen. They don't really have not quite embraced that complete Christian worldview that we should be embracing when it comes to politics. And I'm convinced that Obama got elected because of the Christian church. I've worked for the Christian church, he would not be president. They just he's a black guy, I don't want to be considered racist. But they're not even, it was interesting, I have a gentleman who was doing some work for a contractor a few years ago. He's passing out Bible tracts, you know, he's a real hardcore believer. And he told me he voted for Obama, and I said, how did you do that? Why would you do that? And it isn't, by the way, this was in 08, McCain wasn't a great alternative, but I'm just saying, how could a Christian, a professing Christian, entertain the thought? I said, are you familiar with the church he attends? And I used the term black liberation theology. He thought I was making it up. And I says, well, how do I know this? And you don't know this. So he since changed his position, but and you see that in a lot of pastors, and you probably see this all the time, they're afraid to speak on these issues. If they take a stance on homosexuality, well, maybe someone in the church has a sister or a brother or a child that's in this, and they're afraid to say something. But my goodness, if the church doesn't say it, who will say it?
That's exactly right. I had a friend in 08, sort of similar situation. Said he was voting for Obama, and so I asked him about the life issue, because that's one issue that I knew was important for this friend of mine. You know, he was a Christian, a believer, pro-life, and it's an area where Obama has always been very clear that he supports Planned Parenthood and supports abortion on demand. And, you know, you can have debates amongst people of faith on what's the best economic policy, what's the best immigration policy, national defense. When it comes down to abortion, and that was what was so telling in one of the recent debates, where you had Hillary Clinton coming out and really just without apology, yes, in favor of abortion on demand up and through the ninth month. That is such a radical, really out of the mainstream position. I mean, oftentimes abortion activists will say the pro-lifers are the extremists and the fringe. But when you look at the polls and Americans are asked what they actually believe about abortion, majority of Americans are not in favor of abortion up through the ninth month. So that is an extremist position, and it's really a horrible one, completely immoral. So it's disappointing that people would sort of dismiss that litmus test, which I think is a very accurate litmus test, because your one's view of human life and the ability to just callously dismiss the life of the unborn at 9 months in utero as having no value, that tells you a lot about a person.
In the eyes of folks on Hillary, and by the way, I want to point out, of course, this show airs Monday night, and elections would be tomorrow, Tuesday, and at least in the United States. And it's not just the president. Every seat in the House of Representatives is up, as well as one-third of the seats in the Senate. It used to be that church pastors used to preach Election Day sermons. And you're probably familiar with the history of the church. They don't do that much anymore, and I don't believe it's up to the pastor to say, hey, you know, I'm a Trump supporter, or I'm supporting this person or that person. Their goal is to help the members of the church understand, you know, what's important. And I think if they had the understanding, you don't have to worry about who they're going to make the right choice. So at least they have a very good chance of making the right choice and get involved. You know, you'll say if the old saying that the devil abhors a vacuum. If we're not involved in the who's going to be running for office? It's not that we have some kind of ambition to run for office, but if Christians aren't in the political arena, we know they're already the people who are already there.
Theologian Wayne Grudem, whose book. Politics According to the Bible, I rely on heavily in the Engage book, makes that exact same point. And it's true. I'll oftentimes hear from Christians, even pastors, well, we can't impose our morality on other people, on non-Christians. But the reality is someone's morality is going to get imposed on us all.
That's right.
The question is whose morality. And if we believe that God is true and that his truth is true for everyone, whether they believe in him or not, then we know that his truth, laws inspired by his word and his goodness, are going to be a benefit to the public good in general. Because when you follow God's design, whether it's for marriage, family, or life, we benefit because we believe the world was created by a creator that has a plan, has a design, and we all benefit when we follow that, and we all suffer when the powers that be, the government, does not follow that design.
It was interesting. I sometimes go through Cambridge and have reasons to be there for different things. And over the Cambridge City Hall, right over the doorway, is one of the most strongly Christian, you're probably familiar with it, one of the most strongly Christian messages that was etched right in the stone. And I'm not quoting it verbatim, but it goes something like this, that all men's laws must reflect God's laws or they have no validity. You know, and that was put there back over 100 years ago. And in the Christian church, there are a lot of people, a lot of pastors especially, are afraid of their 501c3. That's their IRS status. And if they go out and say something that may be construed as political, that they may lose that or what have you. Can you address that issue?
Sure. Well, our national legal ministry partner, Alliance Defending Freedom, is running a program now for maybe 8 years, and it's been for a while now, called Pulpit Freedom Sunday. And what it's based on is that you have this thing called the Johnson Amendment. I think it was passed in the early 60s, I think by then Senator Johnson.
Yes, that was Lyndon Baines Johnson. That's correct, yeah.
And it essentially amended the IRS code to say that if the political speech by churches would cause them to lose their tax-exempt status, or by 501c3 organizations would cause them to lose the tax-exempt status, and some churches have filed the paperwork to get that status, and so pastors have become afraid to talk about these things. But the attorneys at Alliance Defending Freedom believe that that's an unconstitutional prohibition on free speech and the First Amendment free exercise of religion, and so they're actually asking churches, and they've had thousands and thousands of churches do this, to preach a quote-unquote political sermon, and usually at some time in October, to either record it or transcribe it and send it to the IRS. Just say, hey, this is what I preached. In the hopes that the IRS would try and take some action against one of these churches so they could then bring it to court and settle it once and for all. And the IRS has yet to take any church up on that. And the thought is that the IRS understands that they would not that Johnson Amendment would not survive a constitutional challenge.
That's interesting. I know that the former mayor of Houston, I think she's the former mayor, outspoken lesbian, had asked to get the copies of sermons from the churches in Houston. And so I think I heard that she got copies of sermons from all over the country.
People were selling their whole Bibles.
Yeah.
And there's a similar situation going on. I think it might be in Atlanta. It's somewhere down south where, again, a state employee is.
Oh, I think yes. I think he was in the
his sermons.
I think he was in the fire department, maybe.
Well, there's Kelvin Cochran, who wrote a book, a Bible study, which you know, had I think one mention of homosexuality in it, and just mentioned that it was sinful sexual behavior, and that cost him his job as the fire chief of Atlanta. And there's another, even more recent situation that I was referencing where someone's sermons were being basically subpoenaed. It all revolves around these issues of human sexuality. These sort of LGBT activists cannot tolerate, ironically, anyone disagreeing with them. And so they want to weed out anyone, even if it's a person of faith, for their disagreement on these issues. Very troubling.
I'm of the opinion that the homosexual, militant homosexuals, there are some that just live and let live. They're not interested in trying to destroy the culture. They're overplaying their hand, and they've made such enormous progress just in 15 to 20 years. As 20 years ago, I don't think there are too many people advocating so-called same-sex marriage and transgenderism. You didn't hear about it. And now it's, as Isaiah says, Walter, they'll tell evil good and good for evil. Now it's been completely turned around, or even any opposition to it whatsoever expressed publicly, you're a homophobe, you're this or you're that. And so it's that it has accelerated that quickly. I remember reading an old magazine from the early 70s, and in the article, it was called On Morality, and it was mention of this idea of, you know, same-sex marriage. In 71, and people, there was talk about it in some circles, the Mattachine Society and the only small handful of homosexual organizations. And now it's, and you know, now we're here 40 plus years later, and it accelerates at quite a quick pace. But I want to believe that they're overplaying their hand, especially when they're going after people, you know, bakers that won't put little two little male figures on top of a cake and things like that. Has anything like that happened in Massachusetts? Are you aware?
Not that high of a profile. I mean, I have spoken with some individuals. The cases haven't been brought to court, but anecdotally, where someone was demoted for basically answering questions about their faith on this issue of homosexuality. For example, coworkers around the time that the same-sex marriage case is being decided asked this individual, well, you're a Christian, so what do you believe? And this Christian person said, well, the Bible says that it's a sin and this behavior is wrong, and made comments like that in response to inquiries by coworkers. And there was a woman there who was a lesbian who caught wind of it and brought a harassment claim, and this individual was demoted. So there are things like that anecdotally that have happened in Massachusetts, and I'm sure there are others that I don't know about.
There was also the case in the doctor at the...
Right, Dr. Paul Church, yeah. That one was well-publicized. Yeah, yeah, you're absolutely
and
right.
And he was a very qualified doctor, and he's simply telling the hospital...
A urologist.
A great man. He said the health risk, I think, was that they were Beth Israel was it Beth Israel, correct?
Right.
That they were participating in the so-called gay pride parade or funding it or sponsoring it to some extent. And he's
right.
Pointed out the medical problems, the health issues are concerning homosexual behavior. And because he simply spoke the truth about the medical problems with people engaged in this, I mean, if it was a bunch of adulterers, he'd be saying something like, you know, you get sexually transmitted diseases and all this. And because it was the homosexuals, he basically lost his job.
That's right. And he lost admitting last year. No, you're absolutely right. And we certainly hope that they have overplayed their hand with the bathroom bill, right? And is forcing women and children to share bathrooms with men who want to express themselves as women. You know, that's going to be on the ballot. We were able to get that question on the ballot for repeal after it was passed in July here in Massachusetts. But it's going to be a long fight to really educate people and mobilize them to go to the polls in November of 2018 to vote to repeal that and restore the privacy and safety of public accommodation.
You know, what really surprised me on that that so-called, referred to as the bathroom bill, there were a number of amendments introduced to sort of water it down, not to be it as effective. People have some religious exemptions and so forth. Every one of them was voted down by a pretty wide margin, even by people.
It's basically a straight party vote. I mean, not on every amendment, but yes, it was voted down by a wide margin, including one amendment that simply said, if you're a registered sex offender, you can't make use of this law to use the bathroom you want to use. Even I could vote it down because, again, this is a highly, highly symbolic law for the transgender movement, because really bathrooms are kind of the firewall, right? I mean, if you want to identify as something that you are biologically and anatomically not, fine. You can pretend, if you're a man, you can pretend that you're a woman. But when we get down to bathrooms and showers where anatomy and biology matters, you know, the jig is up. We're going to say the emperor has no clothes. And so they really wanted to do away with that because their ideology, and this was articulated by the president of the state senate, is that a transgender woman, for example, is a woman. So this is a straight denial of biological and anatomical fact.
State Rep. Paul Hero, is it Hero? Hero? Down
yeah.
in Attleboro.
Yeah.
He's a true believer, I think. I mean, he is just complete. He believes that this is true. Someone in his district, someone who's about 10 years old, you know, transgender, and I'm thinking, well, we're talking about a handful of people, And I would say that you don't find a lot of people, transgender people, in the poor communities. Because it costs a lot of money to get all these kinds of these medical changes, this medical mutilation, and what have you. And I don't know, I'm 56. I went to a public school in Boston. I don't remember anybody who was a transgender. I don't know about you. You're a little younger. I bet you had the same experience. We just didn't have anybody. All of a sudden,
I was in school, but you know, what you've seen already is that, I forget who coined the term, but social contagion. That as this is a mental health issue, and as these issues become normalized and more widespread, you see instances of them increase. For example, until recently, this sort of national statistic you would see for the percentage of the American populace that identifies as transgender would be 0.3%, so less than 1%. But more recently, there have been some more studies that say, well, we think it might actually be up to 0.6, so doubled. Even more disturbing is that there was a study out of Los Angeles that said that the overall population was 0.3 at the time. Let's say it's even 0.6. But that amongst youth in Los Angeles, I think it was 1.7. So if the overall rate was 0.3, 1.7 amongst youth in Los Angeles, or Los Angeles County, that's over five times the rate. So that young people, I think, again, because this is being aggressively normalized and promoted in the schools, and young people are at that point in their lives when they get hormones raging through their bodies and they're maybe experimenting and trying to figure out who they are, you get a fivefold increase in young people identifying as transgender. If that leads to sexual experimentation or hormonal treatments, injections, or, heaven forbid, surgery, those are going to have lasting consequences. And what European studies have found is that about 80% of youth who identify as transgender essentially grow out of it. In other words, they stop identifying as transgender they get into their late 20s. But when I speak with transgender activists, they tell me that children just know what their gender identity is at an age as young as 4. So if, let's say, from age 4 to 20, you identify as something that you are biologically and anatomically not, and you take hormonal treatments or injections, you really shouldn't call them treatments, injections, maybe even have surgery, then if you sort of start to come out of this and realize that that was, basically a social contagion that you were caught up in for a decade and a half, your body is going to bear the scars of all experimentation as you get older. Really, it's a tragedy that it's being promoted to children.
We have just about a minute left, so where can people get copies of the book, or perhaps have you? And even though this show's heard all over the country, even other parts of the world, they still may be interested, and there's probably other affiliates that you mentioned, Focus on the Family, where they can get this done. So give us some more information.
Two websites to go to give you all the information you need. mafamily.org/engage. That's our website. There's a dedicated page to the Engage curriculum. mafamily.org/engage, E-N-G-A-G-E. And then for our state national affiliates in different states, if you go to Family Policy Alliance, all one word, familypolicyalliance.org, click on, I think it's Allies, and it has a list of all the different state groups. We have one in New Hampshire, in Maine, Connecticut, not around Vermont yet, and then in a total of 38 states across the country.
And this book, is it available as a download as well? Is it available on Amazon or just through
website? You can download the PDF. I believe that link is on our website. Certainly, if you email us, we can get you the link to the PDF, and we can also send you a hard copy. They cost about $5 to print, so we ask people to consider donating, $5 to cover the cost of printing. But as I always say, look, if you promise to read it, we'll send it to you free. Happy to do so. That's part of our mission.
Okay, well, thanks for being a guest on the show, Andrew, and we'll probably have you back at some point down the road. And you've been listening to WBCQ The Planet. Thanks for listening, folks, and until next week, God bless.
Thanks so much for having me.